All right. Well, another thing I want to talk about is partnership without paternalism. Instead of reaching the unreached, it's reaching the reached to reach the unreached. Okay. This is a different way to think about it. I think what we Westerners need to do is to have a more indirect approach to evangelism. We're not the front line on the ground troops necessarily. We are equipping the nationals to be the front line on the ground troops. But we need to do this without paternalism. Here's a quote from theologian D.T. Niles of Sri Lanka. Evangelism is one beggar telling another beggar where to find bread. I think it's very important that we don't see ourselves as the bearers of, you know, like we are the standard bearers. Like, there's nothing within ourselves that is worthy. It's the gospel that is worthy. It's Jesus who's worthy. And so I think we need to not confuse that fact and privilege our position somehow. In fact, if the two-thirds world has more Christians than the West does, then I mean, we really need to not be arrogant about this. I think it's hard because in one sense, it's like, oh, I want to come in and I want to help equip. But then you could also come in and help equip and basically try to westernize them, right? And sometimes we do that inadvertently, but I think it's trying to be sensitive to this. I want to talk about something called the facilitator era. This was built off of Ralph Winter, who founded the U.S. Center for World Mission in Pasadena. And he identified that traditionally Western Protestant missions have had three eras of missions. The reason why it's 1800 to 2000 is basically Protestant missions has only existed for about 200 years. Did you know that? It started with William Carey, the father of modern missions, publishing his book An Enquiry in 1792. So basically before 1792, Protestant missions didn't really exist. All right. So this is why William Carey is known as the father of modern missions, because he was the one who spurred on Protestant missions. So we're a pretty young movement. And before Protestant missions, of course, there was a lot of Catholic missions. But Catholic missions differed from Protestant missions in several respects. And does anyone know what is like maybe the biggest difference between Protestant missions and Catholic missions? Think about what do Protestants emphasize? What's that?
Holistic.
Well, actually, in some ways, Catholics are more holistic than Protestants. Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Catholics really focus on social justice and things like that, but what did Protestants bring into the mix? Yeah, it's actually the word, right? Protestants are all people of the word, right? The Bible, sola scriptura, preaching. You go to Protestant church service, the center of the church service is the sermon. You go to Catholic church service, what's the center of the mass, the communion, right? So when Protestants went around the world, one thing that they did that was completely different from Catholic missions was they translated the Bible into the local language. Catholics would go around and preach, but they would never translate the Bible into the local language. So a lot of places around the world did not receive a Bible in their language until Protestants started doing it. Like China. China has had missions, you know, since the Nestorians, like for, you know, over 1,000 years, but they've only had a Bible for the last 200 because of Robert Morrison, who was the first Protestant missionary to translate the Bible into Chinese. So people like William Carey led the first era, hitting the coastlands of Africa and Asia. This is because Protestant missions like sort of came about at the same time as the colonial era. So they just hopped aboard these colonial ships. Well, there was good and bad about this. It was good because colonial ships went everywhere, right? The British, the French, the Dutch, they were the Portuguese and the Spanish. So they were going all over the place. But the problem is, once they landed, the local people couldn't distinguish between the colonists and the missionaries. So colonialism and missions became intertwined as if they were the same thing. They weren't the same thing. In fact, a lot of times the colonists would abuse the locals and the missionaries would save the locals. So that was a little bit of a confusing thing for the locals too. They're like, wait. But what would happen is that mainly it was because they got on ships, it would only be the coastlands that would be evangelized. So look, all the early Christian communities of all Africa and Asia, it was all the coastlands that were became Christian. Then a guy who you might know of, his name is Hudson Taylor, founded the China Inland Mission. He decides to go inland. He says, we can't just reach the coasts. There's so many people inland. We need to go beyond the places that are reachable by ship. So he founded China Inland Mission, the word inland being operative. And then you also see things like Africa Inland Mission, AIM, or Sudan Interior Mission, SIM. And these inland missions started making their way into the heartlands of these countries. Third era would be unreached indigenous peoples, led by Cameron Townsend. Who is Cameron Townsend? Founder of Wycliffe Bible Translators. So what Cameron Townsend realized is he said, you know what? There are a lot of people. We're thinking geographically here by coastlands and inland. He says we need to think about cultural groups, especially ethno-linguistic groups. And he says that what's really important here is to make sure that everybody has a Bible in their own language. So, you know, you may reach Mexico City and you might say, oh, here's a Bible in Spanish. But you forget there's like pockets of indigenous populations who don't even speak Spanish. You know, here's the thing. Do you know that Mexico actually has more languages within its borders than Europe? But most of the pockets are small indigenous groups who don't speak Spanish. So Cameron Townsend's like, we gotta hit all those groups, right? We need to make sure every group on earth has a Bible in their own language. So now, traditionally, all these three were long-term missions, and these were all pioneer missions. In the late 1900s, a fourth era approach arose, and that's the facilitator era. My friend Tom Steffen, who is a biology professor who just retired, wrote a book called The Facilitator Era. And he says, you know what? This is the advent of short-term missions, and this is reaching, empowering the nationals to reach their own people. People like Rick Warren do this, right? He empowers the nationals so that they can reach their own people. And so, and this is the era that we now are in. I'm not saying that the first three are no longer active. You'll notice there's definitely overlap between all of them in terms of time. You can do some of these concurrently, but I think we need to make be aware that there's now a fourth era. So I was talking about the fact that there are seminaries in the majority world and, I repeated that quote again, but the need is for more discipleship, training, resources, and education. I want to talk about John Stott, who passed away recently, but he was the rector of All Souls Church in London, and he was chaplain to the Queen. One of the founders of Lausanne. He wrote the Lausanne Covenant. And so his organization is called Langham. And what John Stott decided to do is, because of this understanding of that we need to have more training for indigenous leaders, he decided to offer these scholarships to two-thirds world Christians to get their PhDs in the West, so they could go back home and then they could train their own people. Now, I do think that in many ways, John Stott had, he was a visionary at the time when he did this. But I do think there's a few flaws in this, right? One of them, as I mentioned, is that he mandated that they have to go to the West. So he said, we'll pay for you full ride, but you have to go to a Western university or a seminary to get your PhD. Now, in some sense, I think, well, there's something good about that in the sense that a lot of majority world universities and seminaries don't have the clout. So it's one thing to, you know, get your PhD at a no-name university in the majority world, But let's say you went to Harvard, right? You got your PhD there, and then you go back to the majority world. I mean, you'd be a big mover and shaker. You could get things done. You could found things. You could ride that wave of prestige and do a lot with that. But I think the goal eventually is to wean yourself off of the Western world. But the other thing that John Stott mandated, and I think this was good, is he said, if you get the Langham Scholarship, in addition to getting your PhD in the Western world, you must return home after you're done. He was really afraid of that brain drain. So he said, you cannot stay in the Western world after you're done. And so that was one of the stipulations included in that. So, but like I said, I think better is, for example, I was talking about Campus Crusade, having these local seminaries set up where the people are. So you can see CRU has four major seminaries in Africa. They also have two in Asia. They have one in the Philippines, one in Singapore. They also have one in Eastern Europe. The CRU has a seminary in Hungary. And they also have one in the Middle East in Jordan. So I think it's a pretty cool thing that CRU is doing, is focusing on founding institutes of training and theological education for two-thirds world people. I'm just going to go a little bit longer, and then we're going to take a break, and then we'll come back for the frontier missions bit. Reverse missions. Okay, instead of from the west to the rest, now it's from everyone to everywhere. And this is the phenomenon known as polycentrism. You know what? Polycentrism is nothing new. This is something that was seen in early Christianity. In fact, the early church, when you think about the fact that God chose Israel as the Holy Land, have you ever thought about the fact that God did that deliberately as a sort of strategic, missiological point of sending? Israel is located at the crossroads of three continents. It's where Europe, Asia, and Africa all meet. And in the early church in the first century, the gospel went three different directions. It went to Europe, right? Paul took it to Greece. It went to Asia. According to legend, Thomas took it to India, first century. And it went south to Africa, to Ethiopia. You saw this with Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch. And so it really was polycentric. And in the early church, you also saw the five patriarchates of ancient Christianity. These are where the five bishops were in the early church. And you think about this. How many of these are in different continents? How many of these do you see in Asia, for example? What's that?
You might see maybe three.
Oh, you can't see? Okay. Sorry.
You can't see any of them.
You got Rome. You got Constantinople, which is now Istanbul. You got Antioch, Jerusalem, and Alexandria. Right? This is what the early church looked like. You have the five centers of Christianity. How many are in Africa? There in Asia.
There could be a case made for Israel too.
Yeah, that's true. Israel sort of straddles Africa and Asia, I suppose.
Yeah, it was west of the Rift Valley than definitely Africa.
Oh yeah, very good. All right. Antioch is Asia, Constantinople straddles Asia and Europe, and Rome is Europe. Right? So it was very polycentric in the early church. And so and, you know, as such, you're seeing reverse mission. For example, I had the privilege of meeting John Sintamu here, who is the number two person in the Anglican Church worldwide. The number one person is the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. Number two person is the Archbishop of York. That's John Sintamu. He's from Uganda, and he's the second highest ranking clergyman in the entire Anglican Church worldwide. And that's pretty amazing. So I was saying here, the largest church in London is Nigerian, Kingsway International. Africa has more and more influential and more conservative Anglican bishops than Europe. You saw this phenomenon that I was talking about with the UMC. You're seeing this in the Anglican church as well. So, yeah. And so, you know, when you think about Christianity, I always tell my students that I think the advent of world Christianity is one of the best apologetics for Christianity being the only true world religion. Because if you go around the world, people are like, no, my religion is true, right? And then I'm like, well, your religion is only worshipped by one people in one country, right? Like, but, or primarily one people in one country. But Christianity is the only religion on the in the earth that has no geographic center, has no ethnic majority, and is really everywhere. And I think that's pretty amazing. So its polycentrism, I think, is one of its strengths. And finally, I want to talk about the Forsyth Church. Historically, you have these guys, Henry Venn, who was British, Rufus Anderson, who was American, and they came up with this concept of the three self church. That all churches locally need to be self-governing, self-propagating, and self-sustaining. Now, you're hearing Nick this morning talk about the three self church as referring to the governmental church in China. And yes, that is how it's now more commonly used, but that's not the original meaning of it. Right? These guys came up with this term in the 19th century, way before the Chinese church, you know, the governmental church took this term. I think the Chinese governmental church has sort of corrupted this so that we hear three self church and we think that's maybe a bad thing. Actually, it's a very good thing. I think it's good that we see local churches being three self. I think that's our hope. The missionary, Western missionaries should be working ourselves out of a job, right? And we should be like turning it over to the nationals eventually. Now, Paul Hebert, the late missiologist from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, said in his book, Anthropological Reflections on Missiological Issues, that we need to actually add a fourth self, self-theologizing. So here's the thing. You can be self-governing, propagating, and sustaining, but still be mimicking the West. Have you ever, I'm sure you've seen this. I'm sure you've gone to indigenous churches worldwide, and they're singing, you know, Be Thou My Vision in Chinese or in Spanish or in whatever local language they're singing. It's like, okay, but I would love to see them write their own songs. I would love to see them write their own books. As much as, you know, I'm talking about Rick Warren. Yeah, but that's great what he's doing. But then you go around the world and you see purpose-driven life in every language in the world, right? It's like, okay, why don't they write their own books? That's what we're hoping for, because then, only then, I feel, will these two-thirds world churches be truly coming of age. And in order to do this, they need money to set up their own publishing houses. They need the education to have their own PhDs and to think for themselves. And so, you know, V.S. Azariah, at the... you read this in my book. He was the Bishop of Dornachal, and he was probably the most famous. He gave the most famous speech at the Edinburgh 1910 World Missionary Conference. There were like 1,200 people at Edinburgh 1910, and only 17 of them were from the two-thirds world, and they were all from Asia. There were no Africans, and there were no Latin Americans at that conference. And of the 17 Asians, he was one of them. And he said, the problem of race relationships is one of the most serious problems confronting the church today. This was in 1910, he said this. There's a certain aloofness, a lack of mutual understanding and openness, a great lack of frank intercourse and friendliness. Friendship is more than condescending love. Too often, you promise us thrones in heaven, but will not offer us chairs in your own drawing rooms. You've given your goods to feed the poor. You have given your bodies to be burned. We also ask for love. Give us friends. Now, this famous speech echoed throughout the ages. Give us friends. Azariah was saying in 1910, we don't want paternalism, we want partnership. We don't want just Western Christians coming and throwing your money at us and throwing your gospel at us. We want to be co-partners with you. We want to be co-ministers with you. Now,
I added this up here. What is this? Those of you who might recognize it. What's that picture of?
Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Abraham Maslow was a professor in the mid-20th century in Boston, and he said, you know what people need? And I think, even though he wasn't a Christian, I do think this is applicable. He says, the first thing that people need, and this is not order of importance, this is order of operations. I think that's very important to bear in mind. Order of operations. Primary thing that people need is physiological. That's the bottom level, right? This is like food, drink, clothing, shelter, air, right? These are just things needed to survive. And as you move up that ladder, the second thing is you need safety. The third thing is you need love or belonging, community, friends, family. Okay, and then fourth, you need esteem. You need a feeling of feeling good about yourself. Right, psychological needs. Otherwise people suffer from depression. And you've seen that on the mission field as well, right? And then finally, you need self-actualization. This means, now, let me point out what I think is relevant here. This hierarchy of needs, I think, in many ways can be matched up with biblical principles. Especially if you look at the bottom and the top. Physiological versus self-actualization. I'm going to make a contentious statement here. I don't think that agape is the greatest of all the loves. You know, we always hear about the Greek word agape, right? What is agape often translated as in English? How do we define agape? Love or charity, some unconditional love or charity. Agape is basically the love language of rescue. Right? Think about charity, right? So there's someone poor and you're rich and you give them your riches so that they get rescued. And they don't die, they don't starve. Okay? That's great and all, and that's wonderful because you're not expecting anything in return. But I would argue that greater than agape is actually philia. What is philia? Brotherly love or friendship. I would say that friendship is greater than charity. Now you might say, but friendship expects something in return. It's reciprocal. Yeah. So it seems kind of a counterintuitive that reciprocation should be a greater love than, you know, unconditional, like not expecting anything in return. But Jesus says, I no longer call you servants, I call you friends. Greater love has no one than this, that you should give up his life for your friends. And Jesus turned his disciples into apostles. He went from this like rabbi-teacher-student relationship to, now you're my co-ministers. Go out and you will do even greater things than I have done, says Jesus, right? And so I think that there is a sense of, when you move up Maslow's hierarchy, what two-thirds world Christians need is actually self-actualization. I think that you see this in the fourth self. I think you see this in Jesus empowering his disciples to go out, moving from servants to friends, moving from disciples to apostles. Because apostles means ones who are sent out. Disciples just means students. And so I think that this is what we need to think of when we think about not condescending love, but friends. Right? This is what V.S. Azariah was advocating for. This is what partnership is. And I think that this is what we see in the era of world Christianity. Yeah.
And to that,